film. You will have a pair of tickets. The film, The Sheltering Sky, is Bernardo Bertolucci's adaptation of Paul Bowles's erotic novel about two Americans caught in a web of heat and sexual passion in North Africa. It was shot on location. Vincent Canby of the New York Times said The Sheltering Sky is stunning to look at, but it is never simply picturesque. It mesmerizes and is possibly Mr. Bertolucci's most seductive, most hypnotic movie. Again, call us at 632-6901, area code 516. The first person to call will win a pair of tickets to see the film The Sheltering Sky. And coming up right now is Brain Damage with Eric Corley.
About time.
WUSB, Stony Brook.
We now return to our recording already in progress.
What did you say?
We now return to our recording already in progress.
What did you say?
We now return to our recording already in progress.
What did you say?
We now return to our recording already in progress.
What did you say?
We now return to our recording already in...
Yeah, I thought we'd never get on. But those opera people have been dealt with.
Has been changed.
No more opera tonight, folks. No more opera.
Two. Please make a note of it.
Okay, it's Brain Damage. It's 12 minutes after 10 o'clock, and tonight on Brain Damage, we're going to be doing all kinds of fun things. Taking a look at the second half of that Big Audio Dynamite record, which nobody else in the world has. And also taking a look at world situations. Saddam Hussein may be the butcher of Baghdad, but who is the butcher of the rest of Iraq? We'll also be taking a look at racism in and around us and find out what the tripods are up to in France, see what's for lunch, and all kinds of other neat things. But first of all, before we go anywhere else, let's go to Moscow.
This is your program, Moscow Mailbag. Here's Joe Adamoff again to answer your questions. The first one today, Joe, comes from Scott McDonald of Mobile, Alabama. He says, I'd like to know the birth and death rate of your country.
In other words, you're asking for the number of births per 1,000 of the population and the number of deaths per 1,000 of the population. The number of births in the Soviet Union is 19. In the United States, it's 15.7. In other words, the birth rate is higher here. As for the death rate, it's 10.2 for the Soviet Union and 8.7 for the United States. Your death rate is lower.
Scott goes on to ask about the infant mortality rate in the Soviet Union.
In other words, how many babies that are born for every 1,000 die before age 1? In the Soviet Union, we have one of the highest infant mortality rates in the world, 24. That's our infant mortality rate. In the United States, it's 6.3. In other words, in the United States, it's one quarter of ours. Many children are abandoned by their parents in our country and end up in children's homes and boarding schools. Now, juvenile delinquency is growing. I guess I've named only some of the problems. Besides, about 900,000 minors, that's almost a million, are detained for delinquency and vagrancy every year. Now, the reason for the high child mortality rate is inadequate medical service, especially in the rural and outlying areas, in places like Central Asia and Kazakhstan, where the infant mortality rate is very, very much higher than the average for the country.
What's the name of the Soviet ambassador to Washington?
He has not been named as yet. Mr. Besmertnikh, who is now our foreign minister, was our last ambassador to the United States, and incidentally, he speaks pretty good English. Your ambassador to our country, Mr. Matlock, speaks good Russian and often appears on our television screens in various programs.
What are the most popular forms of music in the Soviet Union?
If you switch on any of our television channels, I'm afraid the dominating form of music is rock, both Soviet and from many countries of the world. I'm afraid there's a bit too much of it. We do have some very beautiful folk music on our television. You realize we have no end of ethnic groups up and down the country with very rich song and dance traditions, some very beautiful. I'm glad that we promote this in every way possible on our television and on radio. I don't know whether this will surprise you or not, but we have much symphony music on our TV and radio, opera, ballets, chamber music, and piano recitals. You know, the other day, I heard a very beautiful song and dance group of the Cossacks of the Kuban. Their singing was real art. Art in its true form, very touching and straight from the heart.
Do you have any major newspapers distributed throughout the USSR, like the USA Today in the United States?
Yes, quite a number, in fact. What I would call national newspapers. There are at least 10 papers with a circulation of over 3 million. Well, Arguments and Facts at one time had a circulation of 33 million. Now it's down to about 20 million. Trud, the trade union paper, has a circulation of 20 million. Komsomolskaya Pravda, I would say a democratic youth paper, has a circulation of 17 million. Izvestia, 10 million. Pravda, over 9 million, and so on. We also have national magazines with huge editions. The magazine for women in the rural areas comes out in 20 million copies. Another magazine called Rabotnitsa, also for women, 20 million. A magazine called Health, 15 million. You know, many people in this country believe that the New York Times and the Washington Post are national papers and come out in huge editions, which they actually don't.
What's the population of the Soviet Union at present?
The latest figure that I've seen was 285 million. You may be interested to know that we have about 16 million more women than we have men in the country. Because of the higher death rate among men, I suppose they're more liable to stress, and also because of what we call the demographic echo, that is the echo of the Second World War, when naturally many more men died than women. Don't forget, we lost 27 million lives in the last war. That's the latest figure. Then there's a tendency in this country towards large cities. We have 24 with a population of more than a million. 24 cities. I don't think this is anything to brag about. I know that in your country, your people prefer to live in smaller communities. I think this is a good thing.
What's the income per capita?
Yours is around $16,000, I think. Ours is about, well, one-fifth of yours. I'm figuring this in official rates of exchange. But, you know, you cannot judge one's income in terms of monetary income alone. You have to take into consideration prices and very much more. I'll give you one concrete example. Say, a subway ride in the States costs about a dollar, some places more. Here it's only 7 cents. My rent for a three-room apartment plus kitchen, according to the official rate of exchange, is $33 a month. Then, of course, our youngsters can go to college and university and school for nothing. They pay nothing for tuition. Of course, on the other hand, I could quote some prices on the black market and some of the prices in our so-called commission stores. I did this, by the way, in one of the previous programs. The prices there would make your hair stand on end, like $700 for a pair of shoes.
Could you please outline your form of government and how it's run, continues Scott MacDonald.
You know, this is a very difficult thing to do in a brief answer, so I will just limit myself to saying the following. You need a whole program for an answer to that. We have managed to attain, I would say, a high degree of democracy. For the first time in history, we've been televising and broadcasting on radio the proceedings of our Supreme Soviet and of our Congress. Today, you can witness turbulent debates in Parliament, clashes of opinions, clashes of views and principles. And deputies are not afraid to get up and demand a vote of no confidence in the president, Mr. Gorbachev. Or some may speak up openly against the party or against the KGB. One thing our deputies need to learn is parliamentary tact, parliamentary ethics, and respect for their colleagues. There is a euphoria of free speech, no doubt, and often, after many years of totalitarianism, the gene of democracy has, to a great extent, I say only to a great extent, been let out of the bottle.
What are your exports and imports?
You know, I'm afraid our foreign trade is in a mess. Our national debt is something like $70 billion. We actually have nothing to pay with. You see, we cannot export much oil like we used to because we need a lot ourselves and we've exhausted many of the old wells. In fact, 80% of our foreign currency we got from the export of oil and gas. And since 1989, we began to buy 6 times more than we sold. The country has turned into what I would call a world consumer. We are the largest importer of grain, of meat, of sugar, of butter, and other foods. Things we could ourselves produce. You know, our stores are empty. Yet we sold, or managed to sell, over 1.5 million television sets, over 1 million refrigerators, over 1.25 million electric irons, 500,000 coffee grinders, 500,000 bicycles, washing machines, radio sets, and what have you. You know, there's a fantastic shortage of school notebooks, yet we sold notebooks to Mongolia, a total of 44 million. You know, you can for love or money buy bed linen, yet we sold 3 million sheets for almost a song. You wouldn't believe it, but we even managed to sell just plain, ordinary crowbars. Some fantastic inconsistencies. I'd like you to listen to this. We sold over 2 million men's socks, and then and there spent 4 times more money buying men's socks in the very same countries to which we exported ours. I could quote many such examples. On several occasions, we did do some very good business, in my estimation. We sold digital watches at $16 each and bought many, many more at less than $5 each, and they weren't any worse. The country got more watches and a profit in money. I call that good business. We sold nickel-plated tea kettles and bought 3 times as many tea kettles for the same money. So you see, it looks like we do know how to do business. But here's some interesting facts. We managed to import some things for what I would call the chosen few. We bought a total of 500,000 men's coats. Yet in the Netherlands, we bought only 27 coats for almost $500 each. For whom, may I ask? Or we bought about as many women's coats, and 2 coats were bought in Belgium for $900 each. I'll give you another example. We exported 116,000 bathtubs. Yes, just ordinary plain bathtubs. We exported them for a song and bought 4 bathtubs in France at $5,000 each. In fact, we bought 3 refrigerators, home refrigerators, mind you, for $15,000 each. I've never heard of a refrigerator for $15,000.
The last question from Scott McDonald. Could you tell me about your school attendance?
We have no statistics on school attendance, but I will say that we still have not come around to differentiating studies according to the choice of the students. I mean, some like to study arts, the others the humanities, someone else may like to study science, and so on. The high school students are overburdened with obligatory subjects. They have to study 14, and among them, as a result, because they're overburdened, you'll find quite a number playing hooky.
T. Gould of Stratford, Ontario, Canada. Concerning recent violence in the Baltic Republics and Georgia, how is it that President Gorbachev didn't know anything about it? Is it not a leader's job to be on top of such things?
I quite agree with you. It is the job of a leader to know such things and such goings on. The same opinions have been expressed by some of our media and deputies to Parliament. But you know, taking the crisis of our economy and the political crisis in the country into consideration, you daily hear of laws passed that are not fulfilled, of the president's orders and edicts remaining unfulfilled. I'm not in any way trying to defend the president, but I can, to some degree, suppose that he may not have known. There is a chance.
Staying in Canada, a letter from Boutouche, New Brunswick, from Robert Galvin. Temperatures fell to minus 30 degrees centigrade last week. Fortunately, during the weekend, all returned to normal. What's the weather like in Moscow?
Well, this winter, we too had a couple of days when the temperature dropped to about minus 27 degrees Celsius, which is about minus 17 degrees Fahrenheit. But, you know, practically all winter, it was only a few degrees below freezing, few degrees above. The average January temperature in Moscow is 13 degrees Fahrenheit. But, you know, it can get very nasty and drop to minus 45 degrees Fahrenheit, but that's rare. Actually, for the last two winters, I went around practically all the time in a raincoat.
What part of the Union is considered the coldest?
The coldest spot is in the village of Oymyakon in northeast Siberia, in the Republic of Yakutia. Temperatures there fall to, get ready, minus 70 degrees Celsius, which is minus 94 degrees Fahrenheit. But, you know, they say these frosts are comparatively tolerable owing to the lack of wind. This is called the Northern Hemisphere's pole of cold.
How many centimeters of snow is considered a normal snowstorm in Moscow?
Well, I don't know how scientific this may sound, but very often I come out in the morning in winter to find about 3 inches of snow on the car. You see, I don't care to keep the car in the garage, which is about a 15-minute walk from my house.
The last question today from Michael Moffat of Madison, Wisconsin. I didn't hear any of the U.S. broadcasters cover Dan Quayle's statement on nuclear weapons.
You mean when Dan Quayle said that if Saddam Hussein uses chemical weapons, the United States will not hesitate to use nuclear weapons? Well, this was published in one of our papers, but it didn't get any too wide a coverage. You know, Hitler had quite a stock of chemical weapons, and even in his death agony in Berlin, he did not dare use them because it can boomerang back against you. But I will say this, now that the Gulf War is over, let's forget what Mr. Quayle said and concentrate on the future of the region.
Joe Adamoff, answering your questions on Moscow Mailbag. Address your letters to the North American Service, Radio Moscow, Moscow, the USSR. You couldn't do better than write us that letter. And don't forget, your comments on this show are welcome. Mailbag's on the air every Saturday, Sunday and Wednesday. Please note our new times to the East Coast at 2310 and 0210 UTC, and to the West Coast at 0410 and 0610 UTC.
Well, don't you believe him. That doesn't make any sense here at USB, obviously, because Moscow Mailbag is heard every Saturday at around 10 or 10:15 if the opera people are here too long. But other than that, it's heard on shortwave, and if you have a shortwave radio, all those numbers and frequencies will mean something to you. Otherwise, just forget about it. Yes, you can also write to Moscow Mailbag and say you listen to it here on WUSB, and get us on the FBI list, as well as all kinds of other lists along the way. But sure would be nice to hear somebody say on that program that they listen to it on this radio station, you know? I mean, it would make my day. It would make my whole life, actually, to hear Joe Adamoff say that WUSB airs Moscow Mailbag. Boy. But I guess that's too much of a fantasy to expect. I guess our listeners are too cowardly to write in and actually ask a question like... How long do Russians live? Or what color is the sky in the Soviet Union? You know, probing thoughts like that. Well, if you do decide to write, send us a copy of the letter, too, so we can at least know that people are writing. And their address again, Radio Moscow, Moscow Mailbag, or whatever. Radio Moscow, Soviet Union. I'm sorry, Moscow, the USSR. Yeah, that's the entire address. It's kind of confusing, I know, even though it's simple. And our address is WUSB, State University at Stony Brook, Stony Brook, New York, 11794. Our phone number is right there. Yeah, there it is. 632-6901, area code 516. We'll be taking some phone calls in a little while. We have now, on our next portion of the program, last week, you may recall, we started playing the new Big Audio Dynamite record. Actually, it's not a Big Audio Dynamite record. It's a Big Audio Dynamite 2 record. So there's a new band called Big Audio Dynamite 2, and Mick Jones is really the only surviving member of the original Big Audio Dynamite who is in it. He plays guitar and sings. The other people in it are Gary Stonage, bass and vocals, Chris Kavanaugh, drums and vocals, and Nick Hawkins, guitar and vocals. The album is called Kool-Aid. It's produced by Mick Jones with Olimax and DJ Shaps, recorded at Sputnik Studios and the Center for Oral Arousement. And Bad 2 can be found at P.O. Box 48, London, N6SR. Well, it depends if it's a V or a U. One of those. Mick Jones' handwriting has never been among the best. We are going to be hearing Side 2. And the songs we will hear... And I said last week that this album is kind of silly on side two. Let's see if anybody is able to pick up on that. We'll see. Side two consists of four songs. On One, Kool-Aid, title track, In My Dreams, and When the Time Comes. And so without any further nonsense, Bad Two here on Brain Damage.
Kids so pretty anyway. Bevuto?
Ti sei bevuto?
Bevuto.
Il cervello?
Il cervello.
Which means?
Ladies and gentlemen, the Dipsau Calypso.
Ten million tons of water.
neither one remembered falling asleep.
gonna get you.
Coming to your street almost every night, a sound is underground. You're still booming big out of poverty and cleaning up the street. And the man who wants to stand for his piece of land is pushed aside, 'cause he don't quite fit. Try to make him quit and twist his mind, go from behind. Call out to his members and listen, they realize when the time comes, they're gonna terrorize. And I hear every day what you say, that a man can call his right. But when the time comes, they're gonna terrorize. Brother on the street, man, it's more than hockey, he'll be playing guitar.
Bye.
wants to stand for his piece of land is pushed aside, side, side. Cause he's got coffee, gotta make him quit. And twist his not ridden, not ridden, not ridden. Go from behind, behind, behind.
Wow, okay, I have an automatic record player at home, so I never noticed that before. It just keeps doing this forever. That's kind of neat, but I don't really go for the, you know, singing through vocoders or whatever it is he's doing there. I mean, you don't know who he is or what band this is. They all sound the same when they sing like that. Well, anyway, that was, still is, a song called When the Time Comes. And we also heard before that In My Dreams, the title track Kool-Aid, and up on top, On One, from the new Big Audio Dynamite 2 record. No, it's not the second album by Big Audio Dynamite, it's the first album by Big Audio Dynamite 2. And who knows if there'll be another one. Kool-Aid is the name of the record, and you heard it here in two parts on WUSB in Stony Brook. The only place, probably in the United States, that played this whole album through. Because I don't believe it's been released in this country at all, and I don't think it's going to be released in this country from what I've heard. If that changes, I will certainly let you know and let you know how you can go about finding this. But right now, I think what you have to do is find somebody in England that bought it when it first came out. I don't think it's even available there anymore. I heard it was being re-released as a different album. So when I learn more, I will certainly pass it on. It's 11 o'clock. Time to check in with the Tripod, see what they're up to over there in France. We're going to be coming back, taking calls, 632-6901, talking about world events, local events, and all kinds of other fun things. And another fun thing that's coming up real soon.
Wednesday, April 17th at 7 p.m., Turmoil and SD8 present a WUSD benefit featuring, from San Francisco, Cringer. And from England, Citizen Fish. Tickets are $8 and are limited. To reserve your ticket and for further information, call 632-9160 before midnight, April 16th. That's Cringer and Citizen Fish, Wednesday, April 17th, in a benefit for WUSB.
Radio Free Long Island, in dissertation with the Three Village Tobacco Farms, proudly presents the exciting adventures of the Tripod family, the story of one of America's most illustrious families and their struggle to find peace and happiness in the suburbs of Long Island. When I left Kathy and Howard last week, they were in France, and now they're on a train heading to Nice. And as we join them, we hear...
I sure hope we could find that statue, Kathy. I'd hate to return home to Long Island empty-handed.
It's not going to be easy, you know, Howard. There's only one of them left in the entire world. And the only thing we know is that it's located somewhere in the city of Nice.
Yeah, well, that's Nice, Kathy.
What?
Nice. The city's called Nice. It's spelled the same way as the word nice, but they pronounce it Nice over here.
Oh, well, I hope it's Nice town. I mean, a nice town.
Yeah, I've heard some pretty good things about it.
Yeah, Nice things about it.
But it's also a very big town. Now, are you sure you want to go through with this, Kathy? I mean, it's going to be next to impossible to find that statue.
Yes, I know.
I mean, just because you broke Charlie's statue doesn't mean we have to break our backs trying to find a replacement.
Yeah, I know, Howard, but Isn't it kind of exciting knowing that we're going to be on an important mission?
Yeah, I guess so.
Speeding across a foreign land going 150 miles an hour in search of a precious statue?
All right, now, Kathy, let's not get carried away with this thing.
Yeah, oh, come on, Howard. Where's your sense of adventure?
I think it's back on Long Island.
This train in itself is enough to inspire anyone. It looks like something out of an Agatha Christie movie.
Oh, yes. You mean the Montauk Express. The Orient Express.
Oh, are you sure you don't mean the Midnight Express? With Billy Hayes?
No, you're thinking of another film, Kathy. I think the Midnight Express was in Turkey, wasn't it?
Either that or in Greece.
No. One of those places.
Well, in any event, I feel as if I'm in one of those detective films.
I feel like I'm in an airplane. Look at that. I've never seen anything move so fast before. It's a blur out there.
Yeah, I think we're going around 175 mile an hour. Did you know that France has the fastest trains in the world?
Well, they're certainly faster than the ones on Long Island, don't you think?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Howard, look. Talk about mysterious strangers. That man at the other end of the train, he's been watching us ever since we got on board. And now he's walking towards us.
Oh, really? Should I turn around?
No, don't turn around. That's the number one rule in any film. Don't let a mysterious stranger who's watching you know that you're aware of the fact that he's watching you.
Oh. Well, then what should I do?
Here's a newspaper. You can read it.
It's in French, Kathy. I don't know.
He doesn't know you don't know French. Here, look like you're reading it. He's getting closer. Oh, this is so exciting.
It's the kind of excitement I can do without, Kathy. But, oh, yes. Can I help you, mister?
Excuse me, comrade. I could not help overhearing that you and your wife are in search of a particular statue in Nice.
Well, yes, we are, actually. We must have been talking pretty loud for you to hear us all the way over there.
The statue for which you are in need would not happen to be one of Charles de Gaulle, made by the famous Chinese statue maker Wally Truberg.
Oh.
Would it?
Why, yes. That's the most extraordinary of all coincidences. Isn't it, Kathy?
Yeah. Ask him if he can help us, Howard.
Yes. Yes, of course. Do you know something about the statue, sir? Can you help us find it?
Well, that depends. I might, and I might not.
What does that mean, Kathy?
It's your cue, Howard.
My what?
Your cue. Now, you have to say something that will get him to help you.
Oh, I see. My wife and I would appreciate it very much if you would tell us where the statue...
No, Howard. No. That's not how you do it.
What? I don't understand.
Look, if you are Maddox, do you get this person to change his mind by flashing a wad of bills in his face? That usually works.
But I don't have a wad of bills, Kathy.
Oh, Howard, can't you do anything right?
And so Howard and Kathy continue their quest across France for the missing statue. Where will it lead them, and what will happen? You want to tune in next week when you'll once again hear me say, Radio Free Long Island, in coordination with the Three Village Tobacco Farms, proudly presents the exciting adventures of the Tripod family. For Radio Free Long Island and the Three Village Tobacco Farms, this is Don Topeka.
The king, you know why you run things, I don't want to try compete, but I am your defeat, this is Nat, telling you to listen to No Sound Test, 90.1 FM every Saturday night, dance hall set from 12 midnight to 1:30 a.m. on WUSB Stony Brook. Stepping it much.
Coming up in just a little more than 53 minutes. No Sound Test with Kubrick coming up on WUSB in Stony Brook. Well, good evening to one and all. This is Eric Corley in Brain Damage, and we are gladly accepting phone calls at 632-6901. A lot happening out there. A lot happening everywhere. Not least of which is the story of the garbage man, which I don't know if anybody saw this on Newsday yesterday, but it really really cracked me up and made me feel kind of proud, actually, because I like when people stand up to the system, as I guess is no secret around here. This is a guy that is a garbage man. He's somebody that, that owns a garbage company, and he lives in a very ritzy part of town. And he's not exactly letting it be a secret that he is a garbage man or owns a garbage company, much to the chagrin of the people who live around him. And it's the kind of thing that that I just love. I'll read you part of the story, and you can judge for yourself whether this person is a is doing the right thing. The real estate agent warned him. Dennis Hickey remembers her saying, "These people up here ain't gonna like having a garbage man next door." I can't believe a real estate person would talk like that, but that's what they say. Up here in the wooded, rolling Crane Neck section of the village of Oldfield, just north of Setauket, which is very close to here, most homeowners make their living as doctors and judges and university professors. Mm-hmm. Their taste, in fact, university presidents, too, their taste tends toward the rustic and the reserved. Until a year ago, a homeowner who cut down a single tree could unleash the indignation of the entire neighborhood. "People around here don't want anything to change," says Virginia Erdman, who has lived on Crane Neck Road for 24 years. Then Dennis Hickey moved in, paying $2.7 million for a 10-acre waterfront spread at the end of Crane Neck Road. His property is sandwiched between the houses of County Court Judge Alfred Tisch and Dr. Xenophon Damianos, a well-known physician and real estate developer. How can you be a physician and a real estate developer? I don't know. Hickey makes his living as owner of Hickey Carding in Central Islip. His favorite artist used to paint portraits at the mall, and he likes to wear undershirts as outerwear. "Putting on airs," Hickey says, "ain't my cup of tea." The reaction, says a neighbor who asked for anonymity, was generally negative. Hickey didn't much care. So, when Hickey went about fixing up his 10-acre waterfront estate over the past year, he decided to let his neighbors know exactly who he was. He mounted two gold-painted garbage cans atop his ornate stone and iron gate. Proud of his Irish roots, he painted a bright green 32-foot-high shamrock on a giant boulder on his beach, in full view of neighbors strolling the shoreline and in full view of passing boaters on Long Island Sound. Hickey landscaped the grounds with garbage can planters, plastic leprechauns waving lanterns, and a few dozen plastic chickens pecking imaginary grain. A sentimentalist, he placed the first garbage bin he ever installed on his rolling lawn, reworking it into a giant barbecue grill. "We manicured the property to the utmost," Hickey says, and just in case anyone missed his point, Hickey affixed a bronze plaque on the wall outside this man's castle. "The landfill estate," it says. "Only in America," Hickey says, his face ruddy and square-jawed under a tousled pile of curls, is lit with a bright grin. People tell him he resembles in appearance and manner Roseanne Barr's TV husband, John Goodman. Not the real husband, the TV one. "My impression of the man is that he is fully capable of pulling people's legs," Erdman says. "I don't really understand what all the fuss is about. He has the sort of taste that would pass unnoticed on the South Shore. But on the North Shore, people began driving up to the end of Crane Neck Road just to gape at the entrance to Hickey's estate." A lot of gapers around this part of town. Hickey says one particular neighbor repeatedly called the police to complain about cement trucks and other construction vehicles coming and going from his home, which he has completely remodeled. I don't know how you can remodel a house without having trucks coming in, but I'm sure the neighbor had some suggestions as to that. Roused by complaining neighbors, the Oldfield Village Zoning Board of Appeals, one mean and powerful bunch of people. They all live in fear and dread. Even people who don't live in Oldfield live in fear and dread of the Oldfield Village Zoning Board of Appeals, which in the street is known as the OFVZ B of A. Oh, strikes terror into me just thinking about them. Anyway, they told Hickey that his front gate posts exceeded the village's height limits. People have been sentenced to death for less. The ZB of A made Hickey a deal. "Keep the gate, but please, please get rid of the golden garbage cans, the garish signs,
and the two mailboxes shaped like a roll-off dumpster and a garbage truck. Why would somebody need two mailboxes? Must get a lot of mail. David Sipperly, chairman of the ZB of A, says the violations at Hickey's estate were a little out of the ordinary. The mailbox was a great big garbage truck, Sipperly says, and the garbage cans were mounted on the light posts. Hickey took the golden garbage cans away for a short while, but now the cans are back, next to the gate, instead of mounted atop as a concession to neighborhood tastes. The winter comes, people forget, Hickey says, winking. The giant shamrock on his beach boulder remains, too. We hope, sighs Doris Miriam, president of the Crane Neck Association, we hope this will wear off in time. But Hickey's latest improvement, paving part of Crane Neck Road with bright burgundy gravel, is, quote, something that will have to be looked into, unquote. The neighbor who asked for anonymity says that he and a few other residents of the area, quote, think the whole thing is funny as hell, but not everyone is so amused, unquote. Hickey's next-door neighbors, Damianos and Tish, did not respond to requests for comment. Mostly, the anonymous neighbor says, residents are hand-wringing and debating. Should we do something? Should we not do something? One reason for the indecision, the neighbor says, is fear. Some people assume that Hickey, being in the garbage business and all, is somehow connected to organized crime. Hickey and his company have had a few run-ins with the law, and the 48-year-old Hickey once spent 17 days in jail, along with Salvatore Avellino, a reputed member of the Lucchese organized crime family. Hickey helped finance the famed Islip garbage barge. Helped finance the garbage barge, that's interesting. Asked whether he has organized crime connections, Hickey says, I'm in the garbage business, that's all. Neighbors have no reason to fear him, he says. I'm the kind of guy, if you're nice to me, I'm nice to you. He's the kind of guy, in fact, who sent fruit baskets to his neighbors at Christmas time as a peace gesture. When a reporter wrote an obituary about his late mother, Anna, Hickey was very devoted to his mother, he sent the reporter a diamond necklace. The reporter returned it, explaining this was against company policy. I have a feeling the reporter was from Newsday. Otherwise, how would the reporter know that it was sent back? So devoted to both his late parents is Hickey, in fact, that he maintains landscaped, flower-draped memorials to them amid the concrete clutter of his Central Islip garbage depot. I'm just a bum out of Brentwood who worked hard, bought his own company, and did real good, Hickey says. Most of my neighbors, I have no problems with them, but some of them have an attitude. They know I was in jail, and they don't want a garbage man up here. He turns his palms upwards, but this garbage man, he says, grinning, ain't leaving. And that's an article from yesterday's Newsday, written by William B. Falk. And, you know, it's just another example of how people really don't want you to be who you are. You know, it sort of goes down to us here at the university level. It goes down to people in the high school level, elementary school. You're always being taught to be a particular type of person in a particular atmosphere. And it's nice to see someone who has the guts to stand up on a different level. You know, the Crane's Neck Civic Association or whatever, well, they've got to learn that everybody is their own person. Everybody has rights and freedom and the right to be proud of who they are. And if you're proud of being a garbage man, then that's what you got to be. You got to be proud of, I mean, we're radio people and we're not proud of that, but we're sort of, we're not all as much ashamed of it as we used to be. So, yeah, we were getting somewhere. So whoever you are, wherever you are, let people know about it. Okay, and now something that we have to let people know about, which is a very important public service. In fact, it's become a weekly habit here at WUSB. The important and the unknown, things that come together here, especially at a place like this. We're talking about what goes on in the cafeterias of the State University of New York at Stony Brook. What goes on there is anybody's guess, but one thing that is made certain is what's for lunch.
Good morning. Today, Friday, April 12th, at Kelly and Roth for lunch, escalloped beef and noodles, spinach souffle. The hot deli menu is baked ham. Kelly for dinner is having soup du jour, pork chop with herb stuffing, beef and broccoli. H cafeteria for lunch is having buffalo wings with celery and blue cheese, pasta primavera. The hot deli menu is a Monte Cristo. Dinner at Kelly is lasagna, baked lemon fish, veal cordon bleu. Worth cafeteria for dinner is having chicken nuggets, beef goulash, tricolor pasta with broccoli and red peppers. Fanny Bryce Food Mall is open for lunch and dinner, serving Italian, American, Chinese favorites. Thanks again for calling the FSA hotline.
Oh, boy. Well, soup du jour, I'm sure, was quite tempting. Tell you about the time I asked waitress what soup du jour was. I mean, what the soup du jour was, and she went away for a few minutes and came back and proudly said, soup of the day. Oh, how nice. Okay. 632-6901 is our telephone number. Give us a call. Let us know what's happening in your life. Got done with that. Here's an old piece from Mike Royko, which has been sitting around gathering dust, and something that pertains to the Middle East situation. What situation remains? Back to a legitimate and oppressive Kuwait. Despite its having been ravaged by war, there is encouraging news coming out of Kuwait. Shortly after Kuwait City was freed, some residents began publishing a newspaper. It began very small as a mimeographed tip sheet on where people might find medical care or something to eat. But it soon became a more professional journal, and its popularity increased. But about a week ago, a government official came to the newspaper's office and told the editor that he would have to cease publication immediately. Actually, this would be more like almost a month ago. The official was upset because the newspaper had criticized the government for its bumbling efforts to provide food, water, electricity, medicine, and other services to Kuwait City's miserable inhabitants. The editor asked the government official what he had to do to keep publishing. The official said he needed a government license. The editor asked how he could get a license. The official said he could apply for one, but he didn't know if or when it would be issued. So that was the end of Kuwait's first post-war independent newspaper. Now, various international press organizations are criticizing Kuwait's rulers for shutting down the newspaper. They are making the predictable statements about press freedoms, but their criticism is misguided. In this case, the government did the right thing. It must be remembered that we fought the Gulf War to restore the legitimate government of Kuwait, and at considerable expense in human lives and money, this legitimate government was restored. So, how does it look after we have gone to all that expense and effort to have the legitimate government we restored accused of being a bunch of bumblers? Is that the impression the newspaper should be giving, that to restore a bunch of bumblers to positions of power, we killed more than 100,000 Iraqis and devastated their country? Besides, it's quite possible that the newspaper was mistaken in its criticism. True, there wasn't much being done in the way of making life tolerable for the people of Kuwait City, but the paper may have overlooked the fact that in such difficult times, the government had to establish priorities. That paper should have been made aware that while it was, carping about food, water, medicine, and other matters, the government was faced with the urgent task of preparing a palace for Kuwait's ruler, Emir Jaber Ahmed al-Sabah. It was essential that the palace be made livable so that the emir could return in triumph from the hardships of his temporary quarters at a luxury resort in Saudi Arabia. So Kuwait engineers and other craftsmen joined with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to do an almost miraculous job of fixing up one of the emir's several palaces. The one they chose was built several years ago at a cost of a few hundred millions of dollars. The job wasn't easy. They had to order and install dozens of gold-plated toilet paper rollers, gold-plated shower heads, new marble toilets and sinks, crystal chandeliers, cut glass ashtrays, and the finest fabrics and wall coverings, and the most sumptuous furniture for the dozens and dozens of rooms. To get that kind of stuff, you just don't pop into a Great Ace or a Walmart. It took a gigantic logistical effort to bring it in from Saudi Arabia. But that was the easy part. Naturally, the emir and his clan would need water, and not just to brush their teeth. The palace has a huge fountain inside, so the palace has its own reservoir that holds 2 million gallons. It was filled from the city's water supply, and the fountain gushed in all of its pre-war glory. Then there was the problem of electricity. Takes a lot of juice to light up the bulbs and get the air conditioners working in a joint about the size of the Pentagon. So three monster generators were put back in working order, and everything worked. The stereos, the TV, and the electric tooth flossers. This had to be done because the emir is the ruler of the nation, and until he was in Kuwait, the legitimate government couldn't really be restored. But without a palace to come home to, how could the emir return? And without the emir safely in his palace, the bulletproof glass was also installed, how could we claim victory? So that nagging newspaper was clearly out of line. Yes, the citizens of Kuwait could use water, but can their needs be compared to the needs of the emir's great fountain? Electricity? Would they have the emir walk into a room that wasn't properly cooled? They want food and medicine at a time when trucks are urgently needed to haul the emir's new furniture? You have to wonder what kind of whining ingrates we fought this war for. A piece from Mike Royko in the newspapers of March 29th, Chicago Columnist. And I got some fun things yesterday in the store. Found some Desert Storm baseball cards. Well, I guess they're not Desert Storm baseball cards, because then they wouldn't be. They're just Desert Storm cards, but they look like baseball cards. So I've got two different brands sitting right next to each other, competing bands. Now, brands, we have. Okay, we'll start with this one. Both cost 60 cents, I might add. It's one of the many investments I make for this radio station. Desert Storm Pro Set is what this is. It says Desert Storm cards, geography, military skills, intelligence, files, leaders, military assets, personnel, and governments. 10 educational collectible cards. 1991, Pro Set Incorporated, printed in the USA. For free Pro Set Desert Storm cards checklist, send your name and address to ProSet Gazette-DS, 17250 Dallas Parkway, Dallas, Texas, 75248. And ProSet is a registered trademark of ProSet, Incorporated in the United States and Canada. All rights reserved. And 100% of ProSet Incorporated profits from these cards benefits families of Desert Storm veterans. All right, enough said. Let's open it up. See what's in here. Well, 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 we have some cards here. No gum inside, I might add. Okay, let's take a look at this. Jerusalem. There's a little card on Jerusalem. To Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, Jerusalem has very special meaning. When Israel was established in 1948, Jerusalem was divided between it and Transjordan. It came completely under Israeli control after the Six-Day War of 1967. Jerusalem contains many historic religious shrines, including the Wailing Wall, the Mount of Olives, and the Dome of the Rock. Population 468,400, founded 1800 B.C. Location central Israel, 35 miles, 56 kilometers from the Mediterranean Sea. Significance, capital and religious center. This is number 29. And on the back is a picture of, I guess, the Wailing Wall. A bunch of people looking at a wall, so I guess that's what it is. And then we have... So we have a card labeled Leader. We have General Merrill A. McPeak, born in Santa Rosa, California, January 9, 1936. Distinguished graduate of the Air Force Reserve Officer Training Corps Program, McPeak entered the U.S. Air Force in November 1957. He received pilot wings in January 1959 and was designated a Distinguished Graduate of Flying Training. Must be something to be declared a distinguished graduate of. Flying training, huh? From July 1978 to February 1980, McPeak was Assistant Chief of Staff for Current Operations, Allied Air Forces, Central Europe in Germany. He was promoted to General August 1st, 1988, assumed his present position in October 1990, and has not moved since. Okay. What else do we have here? We have military asset. We have a whole big thing on the Multiple Launch Rocket System, MLRS. All kinds of... MLRS is a devastating missile delivery system. The system is capable of launching 12 rockets in 1 minute against entrenched enemy. In Operation Desert Storm, the MLRS was used against the Iraqi fortifications along the occupied Kuwaiti border. Highly mobile on track, it can move quickly, making it a difficult target for enemy artillery or attacking aircraft. This is number 204. How many cards are there? Does it say how many there are? It's incredible. I mean, there's 10 in this... in this particular set, but boy, I wonder how many there are altogether. Then we have military skill, phonetic alphabet. Oh, this is good. This is real good. Okay, this is how you say what this is, how you spell out words, okay? You've heard this a few times probably when we talk to operators. Over the radio, some alphabet letters sound alike. And some military people are completely illiterate, too. So there's another reason why we need these words. To avoid confusion, U.S. soldiers substitute words for letters. A message giving map coordinates Z72B would be spoken Zulu 72 Bravo. What now follows, and I don't think I'm breaking any laws by telling everybody this, I will say the letter followed by the word. Get your pencils ready. Okay. A, Alpha, B, Bravo, C, Charlie, D, Delta, E, Echo, F, Foxtrot, G, Golf, H, Hotel, I, India, J, Juliet, K, Kilo, L, Lima, M, Mike, N, November, O, Oscar, P, Papa, Q, Quebec, R, Romeo, S, Sierra, T, Tango, U, Uniform, V, Victor, W, Whiskey, X, X-Ray, Y, Yankee, Z, Zulu. It's as simple as that. Memorize that, folks, and you can do anything. Government. Oh, the Pledge of Allegiance. What's this? The picture of the American flag. Actually, it's a picture of the American flag on all of these, but this one has a big photo of it, too. The Pledge of Allegiance was first published in a weekly magazine for boys. Did you know that? Youth's Companion, on September 8, 1892. Since its publication, several minor but significant changes have been made. Over a lengthy debate over authorship, the Library of Congress gave credit in 1957 to Francis Bellamy, who had been a member of the magazine's editorial staff. Fascinating. And what else do we have? Mikhail Gorbachev. What's he doing in here? He wasn't even in Desert Storm. Gorbachev, who was known for his innovative improvements and new ideas, became the youngest member of the Politburo in 1980 and General Secretary of the Communist Party, head of the USSR in 1985. He instituted the policies of glasnost and perestroika, openness and rebuilding, and was awarded the Nobel Prize for Peace in 1990. During Operation Desert Storm, he tried to negotiate Iraq's withdrawal from Kuwait. All right, and what else? Geography. Luxembourg. All right, this is a bit of a reach here. I mean, I know they have that... I walked on that bridge. I walked on the bridge they're showing. I recognize this. They have very high bridges in Luxembourg. I guess the reason they're bringing Luxembourg into this is because on top of this mountain that I climbed, there's an international center where all these international people come and argue sometimes. Let's see. Located in Western Europe, surrounded by Belgium, France, and Germany, Luxembourg was founded more than 1,000 years ago. After being under the control of Spain, Austria, and France from the 15th century until the 19th century, Luxembourg was made a Grand Duchy by the Congress of Vienna in 1815. Luxembourg is a charter member of the United Nations for Operation Desert Storm. Luxembourg supplied economic support. Boy, they put the whole country in there because they provided economic support. Interesting. Here's a picture of a helicopter carrying two jeeps. UH-60A Black Hawk. It's a military asset. That's a war bird. Highly reliable UH-60As had logged more than 1 million flight hours by January 1990. And they're on loan to the U.S. Coast Guard for use in combating drug smuggling operations. Okay, this is interesting. Military skill, and there's a picture of a football stadium. Looks like the Dallas Cowboys. It's the picture of their stadium. That's all it says, military skill, and a picture of that. Possible use is this. Range. Estimating the range or distance of objects is one of the most difficult and indispensable skills for a soldier to learn. U.S. soldiers often estimate the number of American football field lengths, 100 yards or 91 meters, to judge distance. Objects seem closer if they are brightly colored, the weather is clear, the sun is in front of the objects, or they are seen from the sea. Their range appears farther if they are dark, there is fog, rain, or haze, the sun is behind the objects, or they are camouflaged. And finally, the last card we have in this series, intelligence file, reconnaissance, picture of an airplane in the sun. Reconnaissance, a French word. Reconnaissance refers to actions that provide timely, accurate information about the enemy and the terrain controlled by the enemy. This information is vital in making tactical decisions. Reconnaissance is often shortened to recon. Many military planes, satellites, ships, and other vehicles are designed for this important purpose. And that's everything. That's the 10 cards that we got here for 60 cents. The Desert Storm Pro Set. No gum. Okay. Wasn't too bad. We learned quite a bit there. Now, there's another set here. slightly smaller package, Desert Storm Victory Series. I guess this came out after we won. Coalition for Peace. It says Coalition for Peace. What do you think that means? You think maybe these have something to do with peace in there? 8 trading cards and 1 sticker. Now, we got 10 cards in the other one. No sticker. This is made by Topps, people who actually make the baseball cards, and people who make Bazooka Joe, too, for that matter. Okay, 1991, the Topps Company Incorporated, Duryea, Pennsylvania, 18642. Let's see what we have here. And these look like real baseball cards, too. Well, what do you know? Here's a sticker for the American flag. Peel carefully and stick it. There's, for some reason, a finger on the back. Index finger, folks. I can just feel it out there. One is profit, the other is non-profit, I am told. Okay. Well, I imagine Topps is the profit one, isn't it? Okay. Let's just make that clear. Now, I don't understand this. If this is a sticker, then why does it have a back with a finger on it like that? It looks like it's part of, what is it? Tell me. Speak. What?
It's probably Norman Schwarzkopf.
All right, maybe it's his finger.
No, Schwarzkopf, whatever his name is. It's probably his finger.
Oh, it's his finger, but what's his finger doing on the back of a sticker?
Well,
what possible good is good? Yeah.
Like they take a picture on the backside.
Yeah.
He was taking the picture, and he's such a bad photographer that...
Go away. Don't need you degenerating the generals of the U.S. Army. Just, if you're going to stick that somewhere, stick it in a place that people will see it at least. Okay, we have cards here. I want to know why it says Coalition for Peace. That's all I want to know. Printing cards about the Agile F-14, okay? And it's printed exactly the same way I remember baseball cards being printed, you know, kind of like with a little box inside and stars or baseballs surrounding it and a number up on the top and a title down on the bottom. Desert Storm Second Series. They're into their second series already. Okay. The Agile F-14. The F-14 is the only aircraft armed with the Phoenix missile, which has the power to destroy targets over 100 miles away. A true Mach 2 plus fighter, the F-14 is only surpassed as a weapons platform by the F-15E. Its swing-wing technology was originally developed in the 1960s for Grumman's F-111, and both aircraft are now being utilized in Operation Desert Storm. Coalition for Peace, indeed. Battleship cannons. Big picture of battleships exploding. Well, sending explosions, let's say it that way. M2 Bradley fighting vehicle. Picture of this huge lump of metal. Top Gun. 3 times annually, 30 to 40 of the Air Force's best pilots compete for 6 slots at the Fighter Weapons School. The winners of these airborne playoffs enroll in a 4-month course that includes 250 hours of academics and 30 to 40 training missions. These fighter pilots are the cream of the flying crop, but all American fighter pilots must meet very high standards in order to get their wings. Sort of like becoming an angel, I guess. Marine APCs. Since World War II, the traditional purpose of armored personnel carriers has been to carry infantrymen across land and water. Soldiers inside these speedy vehicles are protected from small arms fire, and they are usually able to shoot at the enemy through special portholes. A small crew is equipped with at least 1 machine gun and often more powerful defenses. The APC chassis has been used to develop a large assortment of weapons carriers and support vehicles. And then we have the multi-launch rocket system, the Apache attack copter, and finally, becoming a fighter pilot. We'll finish off with this one. Becoming a fighter pilot. The U.S. has one of the most rigorous fighter pilot training programs in the world. After fighter pilot indoctrination, which includes daily flights over a 2-year period, the pilot is assigned to a squadron. There he spends 2 to 6 months in academic and simulator training, where he learns to master basic aircraft formations and weapons use. After 100 hours of in-flight training and dozens of exercises, an Air Force pilot is ready to begin serving as wingman for an experienced flyer. Very nice. Very nice for all those up-and-coming military kids out there. And sure makes you proud. But I really want to know why it says Coalition for Peace on the cover of these cards. It's got nothing to do with peace. Anyway, speaking of peace, you hear they're closing bases all over the country? It's something like 41 bases. And what gets me is that people are really upset by this, you know? Here we have peace breaking out all over the world. We don't need the military as much as we needed it before.
if we ever did need it in the first place. And people are upset at the turn of events. They want their bases to remain open. They don't want them to close. And you have to wonder, what kind of lunacy is this, where people actually want wars to continue and want a large occupational force somewhere, just want there to be all kinds of soldiers and Marines, and when the Defense Department themselves are finally saying it's not necessary, you know? I mean, yeah, it's going to be sad that some jobs are lost, but if it was up to me, you know, if I was somebody that had a choice of being employed in wartime or unemployed in peacetime, well, I don't think you have to imagine very much which one I'd choose. And I think it's the utmost selfishness of people who feel otherwise, think that it's worth it to live in a world of that's a tinderbox just so we can have jobs. Oh, and I'm never completely, nothing ever surprises me, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. 632-6901. Give us a call. Let us know how you feel about all this. And there's also an article on Newsday a couple of weeks ago. Did you see this? The front page story, the turkey shoot? Story I was waiting for a long, long time, you know. U.S. destruction of Iraqi army on run leaves some uneasy questioning necessity. In other words, why did we do it? Why did we destroy so many thousands of people? It was an army without a battle plan. Its soldiers did not want to fight, but they died anyway. Some of them in the last 2 days of the war. They were bombed repeatedly by American planes and attacked by American troops while doing exactly what the United States had originally demanded, getting out of Kuwait. Some of the Americans called it a turkey shoot, as an army that had put up virtually no opposition during the first 2 days of the 100-hour ground war tried to scramble to safety. This one-sided struggle that ended the Persian Gulf War took place not only in Kuwait, on the roads north out of Kuwait City, but according to new accounts from U.S. pilots recently returned home, in Iraq itself, where armed units of the Republican Guard were attempting to leave the border area. Iraqi, is that a call? Okay. I'll get you in a moment, caller, and other callers, please call in now, 632-6901. Iraqi vehicles, some flying white flags, were backed up for miles on roads heading home when they were attacked over and over by fighter planes dropping anti-personnel bombs and then finished off by devastating B-52 bombing runs. Like shooting fish in a barrel was how one pilot operating from the carrier Ranger described his morning's work, as the William Tell Overture blasted from every speaker on every deck of the floating military city, and crews frantically reloaded planes for another swipe at the roads north of Kuwait City. Does that make you proud, folks? Make you proud knowing that we gunned down at least 100,000 people that were running away? I don't know. A lot has changed in the last year, but this is something that I've had a lot of trouble understanding. 632-6901. Let's see who's out there. Good evening.
Hi, how you doing?
How are you?
I was sitting in eighth period social studies yesterday.
Uh-huh.
And I was pondering over this question.
You know, I used to have social studies eighth period, too. That's kind of funny.
Isn't that the worst? It like, drags on. Anyway.
Yeah, it sure does.
Anyway, I was pondering on this question. It's been bothering me ever since, and I was wondering maybe if you can clear this up.
Okay.
You know how Fred Flintstone, like, he drives his car with his feet?
Who, what?
Fred Flintstone drives his car with his feet.
Fred Flintstone. I suppose you were discussing Fred Flintstone in your social studies class.
Oh, no. I was like sort of like dazing, I guess.
Okay.
But anyway, you'd figure he'd get a lot of exercise, right?
It depends. Yeah, I guess going up a hill certainly he could.
Why is he so fat then? I don't understand that.
Well, it's because...
I got another one for you. All right.
You know, I don't know, actually.
Well, maybe some of the callers out there.
Yeah, maybe.
Where does Superman put all of his clothes? You know, when he changes in the phone booth? Where does he put his business suit?
Where does Superman find the phone booth anymore? You notice they just have phones on the side of buildings, and you can't really change there. People look at you.
You notice nobody's ever in them either, you know?
Right, because people are embarrassed.
I don't know.
There's no phone booths anymore, and the ones that you do find don't have those little, covered glass things that you can duck under so people don't see you.
Yeah, they're all open. Or
and if you do squat down, you got urine to deal with on the ground there, and you don't want to do that. You know, it's like,
all right,
it's
my third question is...
Yeah.
This is my third and last question.
Okay.
All right. Cinderella has glass slippers.
Uh-huh.
How come they never break when she runs after the pumpkin?
Didn't they break? No, I guess they didn't break.
No, someone stole them, I think.
I remember something bad happening to one of them, but,
Oh, it's been a while since I read it, but...
There may be plexiglass, yeah. I would have just, you know, slammed them on her stepmother's head. I mean, that would have taken care of a lot of problems right there. Of course, Cinderella probably would have been, like, serving 10 to life for that, but...
it was a fairy tale, though. She can't do that.
You can't do that in fairy tales? I didn't know there was a set of rules for fairy tales.
Oh, who's ever heard of mass murder in a fairy tale?
Well, I think it would make a gosh darn good one.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
I mean, we got baseball cards about, or bubblegum cards, and not even those. What are these? Trading cards about war. So I guess we could have mass murder in fairy tales. What do you think?
I think it'd be a hot seller.
Yeah. Hey, have you bought any of these trading cards?
What, are you kidding me? Garbage.
Hey, you don't think he's going to be worth something in about 6 months?
What, are you kidding? We'll probably have a new set.
That's probably true, yeah, but these are the originals.
A new set of a different country. Oh, we'll probably have it, like...
When do you think they printed these up? You know, maybe they have them ready for all countries.
True.
Yeah.
But, who knows?
All right, well, I want to thank you for those probing questions, no doubt providing me with many sleepless nights to come.
Well, who knows? Maybe they'll be answered within the next 20 minutes.
Yeah, okay. Well, we'll have to see about that. Good luck on your final exam.
Thanks.
All right,
bye-bye.
Bye. It's 1144. Our number is 632-6901. Good evening.
Hi. Can I ask you a question?
Sure, go ahead.
Where do you get that information about this supposed retreat of Iraqi forces at the beginning of the war?
The beginning of the war?
Yeah.
I was reading something from Newsday just now, and this was about the end of the war.
Horseshit.
Well, sir, if you can't keep a civil tongue, I'm afraid we can't keep you on the air. Good evening.
Hi, how you doing?
How are you?
Pretty good. What do you think about that Miss Saigon controversy?
That's an interesting one, you know, because that does bring to mind a lot of the racist attitudes that we have that we don't realize that we have. And, you know, there's a bit of hypocrisy on both sides. You know, the casting of Asian actors, that's something that that definitely should be addressed. You know, you can't...
Right, because I can understand how there isn't much room on Broadway plays for Asian actors. There aren't many roles that call for them. And when one comes to town, that they would want one. But I still can't figure out why, if they already knew Cameron McIntosh, who's the producer, wasn't even going to cast the Asian in the lead because he already had someone in mind, the British actor Jonathan Pryce, why they would make such a big deal about it, because if he pulled out, that would mean that so many Asian actors wouldn't even get the chance to be on Broadway in chorus roles.
Uh-huh.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because I was reading yesterday's article in the Daily News that a guy by the name of Wayman Wong had written.
Yeah.
And he had said that all Asian actors are calling for is a fair balance and an equal opportunity to portray major Asian characters on Broadway plays. And he rounded up by saying that is all part of the American dream. Well, I still think it's part of the producer's or director's right to choose who they want to choose for a role.
Oh, of course, but it's also part of the public's right to protest it if they think it's unfair, right?
Well, that's their right, too.
Uh-huh. So I think everybody's pretty much getting their rights here, but we're asking, you know, is it a just question? I think it probably is a justified question because, you know, we're Americans. We live here in this country. We have no idea what it's like in Asia. And I think, you know, we should listen to people that say, hey, this is not a fair portrayal of people. I mean, there's two different things to this, obviously. I'm talking now about the actual content of the play. And
well, they had changed part of it, one of the songs in it, because I had been listening to the British soundtrack of Miss Saigon on the west side over there. And there's one song that talks about pulling out, like the American losing the war, and one of the soldiers says, well, we've always been losing the war, and we're going to lose it. And they took that part out in the American soundtrack over there. So I thought that was pretty interesting that they did that. And
you think it's right
to that
they
last caller, what two calls before about the bloodiness, like in Cinderella, about what happened to her slipper? And you're talking about what happened if there would be something bloody and like...
Right.
Or whatever.
Right.
In the original Cinderella, they cut off the stepmother when the prince went from door to door.
Yeah.
When they went to Cinderella's house, the mother cut off their daughter's heel and the toes of their feet so the slipper would fit
in. You know, I remember that now. The big fat stepsisters, right?
Mm-hmm, that's
the only way to get their feet in the slipper. Oh, wow. And we think mass murder is inappropriate for fairy tales. Look at all the other garbage that goes on in there.
You see, because when the prince was riding away, he saw the blood-soaked slipper.
Ugh.
And that's what caught his eye.
It was like a David Lynch-style story back then and whenever it was written. Who wrote these fairy tales anyway? Hans Christian Andersen's other people, too.
Yeah, and Grimm's.
The Grimm brothers. I mean, come on.
The Grimm, if the name says it all.
Yeah.
About what you can expect. Okay, I'll call you next week.
All right, well, I look forward to it.
Have a nice one.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
632-6901. Sorry, telephone number rapidly running out of time. But, continuing with the Iraqi situation, it's... You know, interesting, it's hypocritical, it's sad. What else do you want to add to it? You know, right now we're back to our own happy lives, and over there, not only in Iraq, but in Kuwait as well, people are living in squalor. And it seems right now we could not care less. We really don't care about the Kurds all that much because it's not affecting the oil, so we don't really care if we... go in there now and do all kinds of other horrible things. It's going to cause problems, obviously. But would these problems have been occurring had we not started all these other problems? You know, those are the things that we have to be asking ourselves now. But the most important thing in my mind is the numbers, the vast, huge numbers of people that no longer exist, just so we could prove a point. I don't know. 632-6901. What did I do with the article? Threw it over here. Let's check out a little bit more of this. And yes, this is from Newsday. To the bitter caller that can't seem to handle other opinions, well, that's just too damn bad. Like shooting fish in a barrel, that's how they described it. A picture of one-sided carnage emerges from an extensive review by Newsday of the American response as the Iraqis pulled back, both from Kuwait and to positions deeper in Iraq, during the last 2 days of the ground war. It comes from reconnaissance photographs, military, diplomatic, and intelligence sources, interviews with pilots recently returned from the Gulf, and reports from Newsday reporters in Kuwait, as well as the hundreds of pool reports filed by reporters at the front during the war. That is where we get it from. While support for the U.S. actions remains strong, particularly in the Pentagon... That's great. There's going to be a subversive movement in the Pentagon. Right. Outside analysts, diplomats, and even some military officials now privately express unease at what they believe was excessive use of force. And that excessive use of force came during the Allied hot pursuit of a panicked Iraqi army trying to cross to safety on the other side of the Euphrates River. It was an outrage, said a senior Air Force analyst. They were whipped. But other Pentagon officials say that is the nature of war. Air Force General Merrill McPeak. Hey, we had a card with him. Whoa. How about that? Air Force General Merrill McPeak said on March 15th, when enemy armies are defeated, they retreat, often in disorder. And we have what is known in the business as the exploitation phase. It often causes us to do very brutal things. That's the nature of war. And that's why I think war sucks. But that's... my own opinion, I guess. And a high-level official at the White House recently insisted, these were the torturers, the looters, the rapists who were trying to get away from the scene of their crimes. You know, 100,000 of them all banded together, raping, looting, and pillaging. Asked if there were any regrets about the attacks, he replied, no, none. You know, it's very simple to justify mass murder when you say all of your victims are horrible, subhuman people. You know, the Nazis tried that quite effectively, and it worked. The Allied commander, General H. Norman Schwarzkopf, said in a television interview a couple of weeks ago that he thought President George Bush stopped the war too soon. Frankly, my recommendation had been, you know, continue the march. I mean, we had them in a rout, and we could have continued to, you know, wreak great destruction upon them. We could have completely closed the door and made it, in fact, a battle of annihilation. Later, he said he was discussing an initial plan... not a recommendation, but some foreign and American diplomats said that the United States may pay a price for killing soldiers who weren't fighting. Many of these soldiers trying to get out probably had 10 or 11 children, said a Soviet diplomat. And every one of those children is now a potential anti-American militant. Some U.S. diplomats privately agree. They also said they were concerned about the geopolitical implications of the instability in Iraq caused by the war. 632-6901. Good evening. Hello? Oh, well, nobody there. The first few hours of the Allied ground assault that began at... Shall we try it again? Good evening.
Yes. I was wondering, what is the possible use of those cards that you were mentioning? I mean, what could I actually use them for?
The trading cards for the war?
Yes.
I guess, that's a good question. Well, one of them said that the proceeds went to benefit families, okay? So that's one use. The other one, made by the TOPS people, I don't know. I really don't know what the use, other than to trade and to market war as something like baseball.
Do you think I could trade, like, one of those cards for a Mickey Mantle or something like that?
Well, I'll tell you what. You bring your Mickey Mantle up here, and you can have the whole batch of these cards. How's that?
Oh, lovely. Okay, thank you.
All right. All right.
Bye.
Anybody else wants to trade bits of valuable things, show your patriotism that way? Fine with me. Go right ahead. You know, the more you give me for these, the more patriotic you are. Anyway, the first few hours of the Allied ground assault that began at 4 a.m. local time on Sunday, February 24th, quickly dispelled any fear that combat would be long. Dazed and starved frontline Iraqi conscripts happily surrendered by the thousands, according to pool reports that day. The pounding from the air had taken its toll. Let's see. This is a huge article here, so I don't want to fill all the remaining time with this. Okay. About 9 p.m., 41 hours after the Allied attack began, and 49 hours after Bush's deadline for Iraqi troops to begin withdrawing, they suddenly began to withdraw. Allied troops were still a day's march from the city. Tariq al-Rujaib, a Kuwaiti public relations man, said he was talking to an Iraqi soldier who stopped to say goodbye. Can you imagine? Iraqi soldier stopped to say goodbye to a Kuwaiti public relations man. I mean, who knows what kind of distorted views we're getting of what happened over there. When an officer shouted at the soldier, "Leave everything. If you want to be alive, let's go home." The streets began to fill with Iraqi vehicles as soldiers who had no transportation knocked on doors or flagged down drivers to commandeer cars or trucks at gunpoint, he said. With streetlights out, vehicles, some crammed with looted goods, were ramming into each other in the chaos. At 1:32 a.m. Tuesday, Baghdad radio announced that orders had been issued to Iraqi troops to withdraw from Kuwait. Hussein himself made a similar statement shortly before noon. Pool reports indicate that the move out of Kuwait prompted quick reaction from U.S. forces. At 10:05 a.m. Tuesday, the third day of the ground war, officers of the 1st and 2nd Maritime Divisions and the Army's Tiger Brigade, still in southern Kuwait, decided to charge forward to cut off the escaping Iraqis. The intent is to block enemy forces from escaping into Iraq, said a radio transmission overheard by a reporter. American policy had come full circle from trying to force the Iraqis out of Kuwait, which was the United Nations Security Council's mandate, to destroying the core of Iraq's army and eliminating its offensive threat for years to come, a goal that Schwarzkopf said was largely achieved. Diplomats say this weakening of the Iraqi military has contributed to the internal fighting that followed the ground war. Two administration officials said the unstated policy had changed long before the launching of the ground war. The administration was not trying to reach a compromise at that point, said a Mideast specialist. The intent of the administration was not to convince him to withdraw. The intent of the administration was to destroy his military machine. And that's pretty much the story of what happened, according to Newsday. The number of people who died amid the wreckage is not publicly known. The U.S. Army and allied Arab forces buried the Iraqis in mass graves before most reporters reached the scenes. And the Army has refused to release any figures on deaths there or elsewhere. It has suggested that deaths on the roads north may have been kept in the hundreds because the Iraqis may have abandoned their vehicles and fled into the desert. An administration source with access to intelligence reports said that on the two highways north, it is safe to assume that the casualties were massive. Overall, according to very rough American and Saudi estimates, about 100,000 of the 432,000 Iraqi troops in and around Kuwait at the peak of Iraq's strength may have died in the air and ground wars. Combat deaths of American soldiers totaled 124. Well, that's just going to do it for now. I'm not going to take any more calls because there's probably somebody asking some stupid question about Bozo the Clown or something. I don't know. But something to leave everybody with tonight. Thoughts of the cost of victory. You know, it's one thing to lose a war. It's another to win. And this is a victory that I think might haunt us for some time to come. All right, stay tuned for a cubret and no sound test here on WUSB in Stony Brook. I'll be back again next week with hopefully some more cheerful topics, but probably not. Probably be even more depressing than this. So, until then, stay well. Try to live your lives in peace. Drive carefully. And avoid people with one headlight. Bye.
Mushrooming home in a crowd, I'm